Howdy, folks, and welcome to another episode of the Problematic Fave Podcast. This week is a very special week. Also, you know what? Happy Pride, you know? Last week we had this great episode with the drag queens at Series Fest, and you know, that was a great way to kick off Pride, and now I'm kicking it off again with this new episode. Thank you all for listening. This week we have the wonderful artist, urban planner, and podcast host of Fruta Fresca, Jose Richard Aviles. We had a great time recording this podcast. The movie we discuss is Boys Don't Cry. So, you know, I guess it would be fair to say that this episode may be triggering because of the things covered in the movie. So I just want you to be mindful about that. But, you know, we have a good time recording this episode, not because, you know, the content of the movie, just because unpacking this movie now in 2023 is very interesting compared to when this movie was released. There is a whole different vocabulary. There is a whole different mindset. There is still the struggle and the challenges of trans folks. But at the same time, there was a lot in this movie that was very problematic and honestly very difficult to watch. But enough of me talking about this. Again, thank you for listening. And also, send us your problematic faves. We have some, but we want more. So email your problematic faves to thisisdiaspora@gmail.com. Once again, here is this week's episode of the Problematic Fave Podcast with Jose Richard Aviles of Fruta Fresca, where we discuss Boys Don't Cry. Please enjoy.
This here is Brandon, up from Lincoln.
Why don't you leave the lady alone? I don't want any trouble here.
You gotta be kidding me.
Come with us!
What's your name again?
What are you seeing in
him? You won't even believe it.
I'm gonna ask her to marry me. It is so good down there.
You can't just keep running forever. You're gonna end up in jail.
You want the truth, don't you?
I wanna know.
We put your ID number through the computer.
Wow, this Dina chick seems pretty messed up.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Problematic Fave Podcast. Today we have a wonderful guest who chose an intense film to watch, but also an important film to watch, and a problematic one at that. I want to welcome to the show, host of the podcast Fruta Fresca, Jose Richard Aviles. Hi, Jose. Olioli.
Listen, I love the fact that you premised it like that, like an intense yet needed movie, which is definitely problematic.
Yes. So before we get into that, can you tell us about Fruta Fresca, you know, a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, so my name is Jose Richard Aviles, born and raised in South Central.
Work.
Yes, always. Look, I'm a hood bitch. Like, don't be fooled by a bitch. Listen, a bitch can have a martini, but don't be fooled. That was raised on Newports and 40s. Listen.
Newports, not Newports. All right, but I get it.
That's what I was raised with. Old English, Colt 45, Mickey's, girl. Right? Like, I was walking these
Listen,
streets.
I drank Mickey's a lot back in the day.
You know, now I can't. I settle for the 32 ounces. I'm like, look, bitch, it still look like a 40. Stop. Don't talk to me. It's 32 ounces. Don't clock me for 8 ounces.
Sorry for interrupting. No, go on.
I love it. Yeah, I'm an artist and urban planner, which is really random, but also finding the ways in which they all come together. And I think really at the root of what I do is my love for people, place, and performance. Like, I love those three things. A bitch also likes alliteration. So 3P, shout out to Charmed in the club. If you know, you know. P3, bitch. You thought I was going to fit it in there.
That's good.
Yeah.
This is all and, you pop know, culture. It's all about pop culture.
It's all the pop culture.
I love kind of like, because it's rare that you find a native Angeleno, as they say, or like someone who grew up here, who was born and bred here. Everyone here is kind of from somewhere, right? You know, so it's like there is like something very refreshing when you meet a local, because you're like, oh, so you've seen this place turn trashier every single day. Or like you've seen 100. Gentrification, you've seen culture change, how this culture has changed this city. It's so interesting. I think that's
100%. And I think for that reason, I'm like, these bitches is lucky. I am not running for city council, because the first thing I will do as a city council member is put a transplant tax. You trying to move here? Then you gonna pay for being here. Because for one of you, you displaced 5 native Angelenos. How about that?
Oh, work. Well, I'm sorry I did that. But I have been in California. I have been in California for almost 20 years. I lived
See,
in
you
San
count.
Fr-
you count.
I lived in San Francisco before here, so.
But you count. I'm putting the cap at 20 years. You know, that's a lifetime. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you lived in LA for less than 15 years in this economy, then you get the transplant tax.
It is getting weird, though. But no, that's, I love kind of just the work of, like, I love community, and kind of in a way 100. It feels like you are being in this space of urban planning and being an artist. There's that kind of this weird intersection where you could kind of, you're preserving the space you occupy, which is through art, which is kind of dope, right? Yeah.
There's a certain story to certain communities that get told. So, I mean, the big dream right now is to one day write a TV series where the bus is a supporting character. Because we don't talk enough about bus riders. In media or also in urban planning in general. So it's like a two birds with one stone kind of thing. Where the latest shows that we've had about like LA, Insecure being one of them, Vida Gentified, nobody talks about the bus. Like, I want to see the conflicts that arise inside of a bus. Think about it. The bus is the place where people of multiple walks of life are confined in one space. So it's the perfect place for conflict and chaos. And so it's a perfect
listen. I mean, when I lived in San Francisco, that's all I took, the bus. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting going from something that place that's super gentrified, or as like people say, we would go further and further into what San Francisco really is and seeing the avenues as it were. I love that. I mean, I've got to talk to you, but I keep on forgetting we actually are here to talk about something else, but we're here to talk about the movie, but we'll talk more about that later. But yeah, so you chose this movie called Boys Don't Cry to watch as a problematic fave. So, and before we hopped on this call, we said neither of us have watched this, like, maybe since, I want to say, the early aughts, like 2001, 2005 ish. That's probably the last time I watched this. Yeah,
because I think it comes out in 1999.
Yeah, Boys Don't Cry was directed by Kimberly Pierce, written by Kimberly Pierce, and it made its debut at the Venice Film Festival on September 2nd, 1999. And then it did the whole festival circuit and then eventually came out in the theaters in the U.S. on March 31st in 2000. Released by Fox Searchlight, which is now Searchlight. We don't need to get into that. And is rated R. And it was based on the true story of Brandon Tina, a trans man who was murdered in 1993. In Humboldt, Nebraska. And the summary of the movie, this is via Rotten Tomatoes, is young, I already don't like this, this summary, young female to male transgender Brandon Tina, Hillary Swank, leaves his hometown under threat when his ex-girlfriend's brother discovered that he's biologically female. Resettling in the small town of Falls City, Nebraska, Brandon falls for Lena, Chloe 70, an aspiring singer, and begins to plan for their future together, but her ex-convict friends John, Peter Sarsgaard, and Tom, Brandon Sexton III, learn Brandon's secret. Things change very quickly. The movie also stars Lacey Goranson, who is Becky from Roseanne. That's how, like, I recognize her. And, what was your connection to Boys Don't Cry, and why did you choose this?
Yeah, I think, you know, and we were talking about this earlier before we started recording. It's not something necessarily I relate to, but it's part of the canon for sure of queer media and queer films in general. And I think at that time, I mean, I was organizing very young here in LA around like queer justice and queer rights and like safe schools for LGBT high school students. While everybody was talking about marriage equality, I was here talking about suicide prevention and you know, safer schools for everyone. And I think it was just part of that also, part of that training, I was very fortunate to also have been politicized and organized by a lot of queer folks in my life. And so part of that conversation was like, watch the films that are being put out there about queer representation. Yeah. And on the flip side, I think jumping into a little bit of the conversation, let's also watch the films that no one is talking about. So at the time, in addition to Boys Don't Cry, another film that comes very much to mind is a play then turned into a film, but The Laramie Project, which is about Matthew Shepard. And so we remember watching these two movies, and I remember just some of the organizers being like, what do they have in common? And we were like, well, there's so many things, but the first thing is that they're white and small town. So how does one, as a brown queer person from LA, relate to it? And I remember thinking, I mean, a lot of the time it was like used as also, again, to flip the script. Like, these are the movies that are being put out there. Brokeback Mountain, you know, again, early 2000s, mid-2000s. Yeah. But nobody's talking about Gwen Araujo, who was a trans Latina woman that was murdered around the same time that Matthew Shepard was. Nobody was out here talking about Marsha P. Johnson or Sylvia Rivera, but a homegirl knew those names in the early 2000s, because it was part of the flipping of the script that I was organized and politicized with. Mind you, at this time, I'm like 15. So at this time, you're being like... Yeah, one of the fun things for folks, I mean, folks are here in California, we observe Harvey Milk Day, which is a thing here in California, right? The first openly gay elected official in San Francisco who was murdered with something called the Brownie Defense. And yeah.
Twinkie defense.
The Twinkie, not the brownie. Well, girl, that brownie is livid.
Well, you know what? It's fine. It's like it was a snack.
It was a snack. It was because of a
sugary snack. It was a bad defense too.
Girl, so bad. But the funny thing is that I was part of the youth group who lobbied Sacramento to get Harvey Milk Day as a thing. So
word.
Yeah. So
look at you changing the world. You're looking at you changing while I sit here and talk about be a bitch about movies in Hollywood.
Oh, listen, I love a bitch. Listen, I'm like, look, I may be an artist, but a bitch also has to critique and consume art. Oh, so, like,
Listen, I'm like, I keep on telling people right now that I'm in my Tennessee Williams era because I'm like, I'm currently reading his biography, and his biography is juicy, mama. Like, he was a petty ass bitch, and I loved him. And he was so talented. So talented. He had different trade every night. It's a very dense biography. But like, listen, it's like, I'm in like this Tennessee Williams era, and like just really kind of the whole humanity of it all, I think. And like, I'm watching plays and shit. I'm like, it's an interesting time for arts right now, let's say. But no, what you were going back to saying about this era of like movies, of these queer movies back in the day, is like these forefront stories of like, you know, and you know, it's not like, it's by no means is it a trauma wars thing. It's just that there was a lot going on, and then there is, I'm not gonna lie, when the majority of the coverage is, you're like leaving out a lot of the story. That's when kind of like problems occur with like kind of leaving, you know, trans people of color out of the story, you know, saying this is the, when we see movies of like back in the day when it was, you know, when gay representation was supposedly a thing, you know, it was the gay that Hollywood wanted to show us. You know, it was
Which very much like Boys Don't Cry, Brokeback Mountain, like in a lot of the movies that are coming out in the early 2000s, late 90s about queerness, the one thing that they have in common is that they substantiate or validate our queerness through traumatic events.
Yes. And then that's kind of, I'm not gonna lie. When I was watching this, it was very, very difficult to watch. I did cry in some parts. Like, I was, like, bawling in some parts. Specifically, that part. Actually, that part. Multiple parts. Because once...
That part, multiple parts.
Once you think you're done with, like, the bad of it, it gets even worse. And that's what I did not like. Yeah.
Here's the thing. I don't know if you felt this, but I feel like a lot of the times, like, I feel like queer narratives are also sort of arced in, like, this is the character. And really what it happens is their coming out journey. And that's what we witness. And there's some traumatic event that causes the conflict. And then, you know, we see the resolution come through. In this movie, we have already substantiated or, like, validated. We have accepted as true that this person is trans from the beginning.
Shorter hair.
Shorter?
Shorter.
That is short enough. So you're a boy. Now what?
Yes, from the get, from the jump.
And so then I was like, okay, cool. Okay, so what? Where's the conflict? Like, what's the thing? And I feel like I was into the movie maybe 60% into the movie, and I was still waiting for the conflict. And then it's so funny that Rotten Tomatoes was like, and then things change quickly. I'm like, yeah, bitch, in the last 15 minutes, it was like unfolding.
Yeah, it was, I think this was just, you know, from the beginning, it was clear that, okay, and to see something as bold as that beginning in 1999 and 2000 is very interesting because this was when a lot of people had no nuance of gender expressions, no nuance of what sexual identity was, where even queer people weren't aware, I was not aware, well, of like any of like gender expressions, what trans was. And then also, I'm not going to speak, I don't know. The sock situation was like all...
That is the most frightening thing I've ever seen in my life. It's like a deformity.
I'll fix that.
I'm not speaking for the trans community. I'm like kind of, I don't want, I just like all, I don't know if people do that because that's not really what I think a lot of trans people are trying to stay away from the genitals of it all.
Okay, so can we break some of this down? So I'm here for it.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah, go do it. Yeah, talk about the sock, please. I'm like...
So I think the first thing that you brought up was very interesting. I'd be curious. Part of the reason why I was also very curious to bring this movie into the conversation is because, I mean, I don't necessarily know that Brandon was a trans man. Not invalidating. I think it's very real, but I'm also thinking about, I think we were talking about context culture, right? And in the context of 2000, we had not established necessarily a collective language like non-binary like we do now.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I
mean?
Even
though it did exist then, but people weren't practicing it at all.
Right. Or finding this, again, the collective language that we now have as a signifier, like you self-identify, and I think collectively folks know non-binary. What you feel towards non-binary folks, that's another episode. That's another episode. But I do feel like, for example, the relationship between gender and sexuality in this movie is still very heteronormative. Even from a homonormative standpoint, right? Like, there's very clear definitions of what gender and what it means and what you need to then become a man, which I think it's very much like the reason for the packing, right? So people, I mean, I know people that pack now? I don't think so. I don't know. But I think it goes back to that, you know, at some point, like, the realness of passing is very true. You know what I mean? And funny enough, there's so many things. So there's that element for sure, and the obsession with genitalia.
You are not a boy!
Tell them that. They say I'm the best boyfriend they ever had.
Yes.
That I think comes out so much in this movie. You know what I mean?
Oh! Especially that moment, which I couldn't watch. We'll get to it. Don't worry, listeners. We're going to get to it soon. But no, I think... I loved what it makes so much sense because it was just watching this, I felt uncomfortable throughout. Not because I was just like, it kind of proves that we have come so far. Even that this movie was supposed to be kind of like, I don't want to say the gold standard, but Kimberly Pierce was doing something and taking chances, making a risk of telling this story, and you could tell that she cared for it with like how she was unpacking it. Granted, I don't know who in the team identified as queer, I'm not 100% sure in like what kind of consulting they got. I think they met with one of Brandon's family members. I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm not saying that there was zero care in this movie. It's just that it's just so complicated to not complicated, but interesting to dissect kind of where we were in that moment in time when it comes to queerness and gender expressions and sexuality.
100.
And it makes me sad and it makes me like happy at the same time. Because we haven't 100%. Come far, but we have come somewhere.
Far. I remember just being a young organizer at like 15, 16, and I'm 32 now, so like 16 years ago. But, you know, thinking about like in that young age, using gender pronouns, we used to call them PGPs, preferred gender pronouns for cute and short. And that was hella radical, but it was so normalized in our group of young queer organizers. We knew we were being hella radical of like, my preferred gender pronouns are, even whatever the pronouns were, and my pronouns have definitely changed from when I first was organizing to now, to even thinking about today, we're like, fucking everybody got a DEI statement, everybody got pronouns in their fucking signatures. I'm like, bitch, shut up.
It's like, but and I think what is really good about this movie is that it did teach me about a certain gender expression. And also, I was looking at this movie back in the day, I'm like, oh, I think I was still closeted back then. She's 44, y'all. So just to make sure, you know. But no. But mother. It's kind of, mother is no.
The way it took you 3 seconds to process.
Right? Listen, I'm Beyonce's favorite number twice.
Oh, what's up? Okay.
No, I mean, listen, I've been sleeping before 11. Before. I slept at like 10:30 last night and woke up at 6, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and read a book. It was like I was
read a book. Did you drink chamomile tea too? Like, what would you do?
I might as well.
The only thing I mean,
I'm leaning into my auntiness. I'm leaning into my auntiness. My teeth, you know, my well, at Filipinos, we call our aunties and uncles. We say tita and tito, you know.
Oh, similar to Tio.
Yeah. We were both colonized by the same country. We share similar languages and stuff. So.
We share the same generational trauma.
Yeah, you know. And even to this day, United States' relationship with the Philippines is hella shady. But you know what? That's another podcast as well.
I love this.
No, I think watching this just made me kind of like, I think I wasn't quite computing what was going on. Like I was all, I was attracted to this material, but I didn't know why, you know, that I needed to know this information in some sort of way. And, like back in the day, right. You know, like, oh, this is queer. And I was automatically gravitating towards a lot of queer things. Like I think this came out like when I was a sophomore in college, and then something like, and then I was watching, you know, movies like Muriel's Wedding, which is totally queer, back in the, you know, when I was in high school, and listening to Pet Shop Boys, and you know, I was like, oh, I'm supposed to, like, my friend, I was surrounded by a bunch of closeted gays and girls. I was in marching band and choir. Listen, we. but I just think this movie. There's something very poignant about this movie, and I think Kimberly Pierce, with what she had and with where we were at that time, she did a really, really good job. But if I would looking at it now, I'm like, I cross my arms and I'm all, I don't know about this, you know. But 100%. I still feel the importance of the movie.
There is these moments where a lot of the traumas were rooted in flashbacks. And so when you think about it, there was some sort of satisfaction in knowing that the person made it through.
Yes. Yes. I like that. I get what you're saying, because I texted one of my friends right after watching this, and I was like, oh my God, I had to watch Boys Don't Cry again. And also, this movie is a straight up, almost like a psychological horror or a thriller. There, it was giving horror. And 100%. I was just like, because I was scared. I was genuinely scared. Because we know it doesn't end well, you know, for Brandon. But there's this, like, interest. And then there are moments when Brandon has such optimism and it's just heartbreaking to see. Right? It's like, all this was the time when gay people couldn't have joy. Where you know what people couldn't have joy, yeah.
100%. You know what I thought was very, very, very... There's a scene in the bathroom.
Wait, not that scene. Is it that scene where they strip Brandon? Not that one.
Yeah, no, that scene.
That scene. Oh, okay. Yeah, the horrible scene, yeah.
100%. I mean, again, the obsession with genitalia really, really comes out that it's hella problematic as we're having conversations now about queerness and queer media, trans community, all that stuff.
Yeah.
There is something that I found very, very interesting that I was like, holy fucking shit. This is the moment that I think not a lot of people know how to capture or how to communicate that I was here for. But that moment where time freezes for everyone except Brandon.
Yes.
And you see Brandon looking at himself on the back in the back. And I'm like, that's disassociation.
Yes,
we don't talk enough about, like, again, the dissociation. And again, I think cinematographically, I think it was done beautiful in the sense that it didn't require CGI and just so much of the practical effects that you can bring in to emote such complex emotions. Like, I don't think I've seen so many moments and times in where... And how folks disassociate from traumas. And I think I was like, oh, shit, yeah. And your optimism, right? Like, Brandon was constantly creating the future, which is something like, I don't know how many times. Can I ask you a question? I'm curious.
Yeah.
Did you think that you would make it to 44 as a young queer person?
Me? Right now? You know, this is so interesting. Because my queerness... I identify as gay, he, him. It's still a journey for me because it's kind of like, you know, I'm of that generation between Gen X and Millennial, as they call Zennials, right? This really, I call it the bastardized generation. We know how it's like to, we know how it's like to grow up without the internet, but we also grew up with the internet, you know? We know how it's like to have a pager, but also know how to have an iPhone. We are in this really weird thing. So it's like, and my dad, my family, I come from a military immigrant family, Philippines. Both of my parents immigrated here. Catholic, all congratulations, conservative.
100.
I think they recognize my queerness, but we don't talk about it. Also, my queerness is what has made my life, period. I'm sorry. I was like, you know, I'm not apologizing for it. I'm just like, it's just like, it's what has made my career. My Asian-ness, all the others about me has made my career and has made my life. And I think I'm also trying to embrace that. Whereas if I never thought about surviving until 44. I've always just thought about, like, all, I just want to survive, right? I mean, I know I laugh, but I laugh out of kind of this weird discomfort. Mm-hmm. It's like,
100.
I've talked about this before with some friends about, like, how when we're young, especially if you're a woman of color, a Black woman specifically, someone who is queer under the queer umbrella or whatever, as you are young, you know you're different, you just don't know what it is. And you learn so fast to protect yourself, even though you don't know that you are protecting yourself. You learn fast to build that armor, no matter what it takes. It's like, I didn't feel safe when I was always like a chubby kid, right? I was always a chubby. I got my peak weight was like 215 or something like that at one point when I was in high school or college, excuse me. But like when you're young and you're queer and you know you're different, you find ways to protect yourself so that you could fit in. And so like doing that, and it wasn't until my late 20s and like early 30s when I just started to stop doing that. And I'm still starting, you know, I'm still trying to unlearn a lot of things that I was taught. So I think right now is like, oh, that's just a long way of saying I didn't even see 44. Like, I didn't, I think I was just like, what's the next year going to be like? I never knew what my future, I never had role models in terms of like, I never knew a Filipino queer journalist or podcaster. It's like, I'm kind of paving this own road in this weird way and just trying to survive in a trash world.
That's 100%. No. And the reason I asked that question is because I have a very similar response. I don't think I knew. I saw. I won't even say an age at which to cap it, but it's interesting where exactly that. Like, it was, I never saw the future because I was constantly living in survival, right? Mm. And I knew the things that were coming at and being thrown at each other as a queer person, as being born and raised in South Central in the early 90s, and living, you know, that experience and all that it was, like, very similar to you. I think I was just constantly surviving. And also similar to you, I feel like I'm entering a new phase of my queerness because it's unprecedented. Queer adulthood is not something I ever envisioned.
No, because it's like, you know, when we watch, you know, two men or two women or two, you know, any under the gender spectrum get together, all varieties, we are not used to that. We're still not used to that as a collective whole, as you say. And it's like, I am, but, you know, like 90% of the world isn't, or something like that. You know,
And interesting, right? Going back to the film, the one thing that we did know was the violence enacted on queer bodies.
Yeah.
So those are the only places that you can tell these narratives from the place of violence.
I look at Brokeback Mountain, you know. 100%. It ends, you know, with him getting, Jakey getting killed or whatever. And 100%. With this, it's just like, I want to go to the bathroom scene that I really, really, really do not like. And I do like how you said, I saw it was basically the same thing, like an out-of-body experience. Like, Brandon knew that was happening to him right there, but he decided not to pay attention to it, basically. He's like, oh, this is happening, oh well. Not like that, but, you know, this is happening. And it's just like, I think there's a point in trauma where you just, like you say, disassociate. You're just like, okay, this is happening and it's going to happen and I don't know what to do. And even with that kind of, that whole, how it was staged, there was something very almost Renaissance painting about it. Like the way that it was, the light was shining on, and he was like almost like Christ, like this Christ figure.
100%. And there was with Judas.
Yes!
The women, right? That you think are going to be your allies in this conversation are just standing and watching the spectacle of you being oppressed. Yeah. And assaulted, it, really.
But there's, I don't know if Kimberly Pierce meant this, because I guess, you know, what's Chloe, Lena. Characters. Chloe was trying to stop, or Lena was trying to stop, and then Peter or John says, kneel down and look at what you're in love with.
John, let me go!
Don't look like no sexual identity crisis to me.
I'm holding you until you look. Look!
And that's very Mary Magdalene Jesus, right? Oh my God, look at us. We are so religious.
100%.
But even after that scene, and then like, they take, I couldn't watch when they took Brandon and then stripped it and then raped. Couldn't watch. I did not. Yeah. I actually stepped out of the room and I just heard it. And then I was smoking a joint on my balcony.
Wow, that sounds good. Nice.
I need to calm down, because this scene, I don't even know what happens in that scene. And I don't want to know what happens in that scene, because I just couldn't watch it.
That's fair. I watched it, and, and, you know, without getting into details, there, one thing I noticed even as we're having this conversation, there wasn't a cinematographical code for disassociation. Like, Kimberly Pierce chose to have Brandon not disassociate in the same way we had seen the bathroom scene.
Wow. So there wasn't a moment where It's just like all Brandon was living in that moment because it's so real.
It's so real. Right. Yeah. And also that is a lot of what queer, and here's the thing, I think so much about queerness, and I think it's something in particular that gay men also need to hear, is that queer, to me, the difference between queer and gay is toxic masculinity. Because it lives in all sexualities. But there is a lot of the times there, you know, in the term that's used of what happens, and trigger warning for folks out there, is corrective rape.
Oh, God. That just kind of, like, gutted me when you said that out loud. It's, like, two words that don't even belong together, right?
100%.
Yeah.
It's so much of what our siblings have gone through. And even in the gayness of the masculinity, what is our commitment to step in those moments? You see, like, to me, that's this is an unpopular opinion, and we could talk about this on another episode. But I'm a firm believer that capital Q queer is only limited to bodies of color. Because
work. Oh,
listen. So what I have Beyonce,
a feeling this is going. This is. I have a feeling this is going to be a segment that we're going to cut out and put it in the social asset.
Oh, this is a social asset set, bitch. For real. And cue the editing. No, but I truly do believe. I believe that capital Q queer is only limited to bodies of color, and lower Q queer can also include white bodies, because of course part of the queer politic is not to define another person's queerness. But baby, when Beyonce said thank you to the queer community for creating the genre when she won her Grammy, Brandon, she wasn't talking to you. Cameron, she wasn't talking to you. You know, Sean, she wasn't talking to you. Like, no, take a seat.
Come on, Brandon, Cameron, and Sean, where you at?
She was talking to you. She was talking to the queer black and the queer brown trans folks who created the genre, right? Like, she was talking to you, girl. No. But again,
you know what?
So I go.
Yeah. Go on.
And I say that all the time, like, right? I think I don't choose my sexuality, but I choose my politic every day. Every day. And when we think about queerness as like a contradiction to the binaries of gender and sexuality, it also is a contradiction to the binary of race. And so until racialized bodies are at the forefront of power, queerness does not include white bodies.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I'm not going to lie. I kind of love that. We're not excluding anyone. We're just making things clearer.
Right. We get capital Q, you get lowercase Q.
Everything's fine. Everything's fine. But, you know, it's, right. I'm glad you said that about the rape scene. The capital Q and lowercase Q is also something that's going to be fun. because the fact that Kimberly Pierce made that choice is very interesting to me, because what I think is that what the intention is to be like, oh, this is real, this is happening. Whereas when Brandon was getting stripped, it was very, like I said, like a Renaissance painting, when this was just like, just disgusting. It was absolutely horrid, disgusting. And I, so much that, you know, just hearing it, like, kind of brought tears to my eyes when I was in the other room. I'm just like, I can't. I cannot handle treatment of, like, bad or abuse of women of color, trans women of color, trans people. I cannot handle that abuse. That's why. But the fact that Kimberly Pierce made, I want to talk to her now. I did talk to her once at a party. But I forgot what we talked about. But I'm just very curious about these choices that she made.
100%. And I think, you know, it's another little funny problematic moment that happens in the film.
Well, funny. Another one? There's another one?
Yeah. When Lena, also shout out to Lena for being that partner and that lover. Of being like, bitch,
about
what the
like,
fuck?
Saying that, what did he say? It's like, I don't care if you're a monkey with hair on your back, I'm going to get you out of this jail or something like that.
What are you doing here? The girl's cell?
Has both girl and boy parts. I don't care if you're half monkey or half ape. I'm getting you out of here.
Right.
And that was like, that was the moment I was all, that was the moment of joy you saw, like, where Brandon was all, oh my God, you love me no matter what. And that's what 100%. I kind of like, I want to hold on to that, but
yeah. Alas. But it was interesting when Brandon came out to like, right, because I think it's also part of the queer narrative, which is something the way that I think I connected with. But like the hyper, I mean, okay, I don't know. But when Brandon came out to Lena, he describes himself as a hermaphrodite.
Yes, that was a little problem there.
100%. Well, we do not use the word hermaphrodite, y'all. We do not pathologize people. The word is called intersex, and intersex is also a spectrum.
No, there have been a lot of intersex documentaries. I saw one at South by Southwest, and it was just very fascinating. And I forgot what the name of the movie was, but it was just, and then there's another movie coming out. Is it about intersex? It's called Everybody. It's actually playing at Tribeca. Let me see. I think it's called Everybody. Yeah, it's called Everybody by the director Julie Cohen, who is a great documentarian. She did RGB. My Name is Polly Murray. I loved those two. This one is about intersex people. And then there was another one about intersex people. And I think I'm glad that more of that conversation is coming out. However, I think it's just gonna go through that same process of like, but a little bit faster, of how trans representation has been portrayed throughout the years, because intersex is brand new to a lot of people. People don't know how to, you know, approach it. So there's gonna be mistakes, I think. 100%. Yeah.
100%. I mean, again, even like, again, the word, the H word, which is like, oh shit, I have not heard that in a long time. But you
it's
know
so
what?
Archaic.
It's so archaic, 100%. And what I try to get to is that, one, we do not know if Brandon was actually intersex or not. But what's interesting here is the idea of having to find a way to justify the in-betweenness of it all. This is the first time that Brandon even associates some form of transness of like, I'm not a cis person to Lena, and may not have the language. And the only language that we know is, I have both boy girls, both parts and girl parts. Which it might necessarily not be true, as opposed to just like, I am a boy, I am a man.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's interesting to think about how the only thing I can think of is like, as a queer body, how having to also become a compulsive liar to justify the queerness. So like, I remember growing up in elementary school and people asking me like, why do you walk like that? Why do you walk like such a girl? And I remember me being like, I got in a car accident and now I fucked up my ankle. So there's like a little switch, bitch.
Not a car accident. No, girl. Listen, this is why gay people are creative too. You know,
what's up? Like, my imagination's been on work. I'm like, people, listen.
No, but that's sad that we all had to do that. It's just like, I think every time someone asked me if I was gay in college or whatever, when I wasn't out, and when I said no, it's a little jab, it's a little stab in your stomach. Yeah. It's
100%.
It's like, I think, you know, this movie, although, yeah, it's very, very difficult to watch, in my opinion. But I will say that I think Hilary Swank honored the role and respected Brandon. I feel like with the performance, I feel like Hilary Swank did a good job. She won the Oscar, obviously. And then also Chloe Sevigny I think every actor in this movie did a good job. It's just that the movie is very not fun.
You know what? I didn't realize that was Peter Skarsgård.
Yeah, work. Yeah. He plays a good meanie. He plays a good asshole, a good racist, homophobic piece of shit. But also, that other guy, the other actor, I've seen him in other things, and he just has that face where you know he's gonna fuck shit up, and he's gonna be a horrible human being. But I just say that, like, speaking of them, it's just like, and you mentioned this earlier about toxic masculinity, gay toxic masculinity even, it's just like, that was so embedded in this, and it's like a lot of instructions on how to be a man, how, what defines a man, like, if, I feel like, this is what I wrote down while I was writing it, it feel like this movie was a series of humiliations for Brandon Tina, with a really horrible ending. And it's like, yeah, all just at the moment when you think Brandon's going to get some joy, they take it away from him and then give him another humiliating moment. And that's kind of where I'm just like, oh, there's no payoff. You know, I don't, I feel like it honors Brandon, yes, but it's like, oh, I just wish it was different.
Yeah, no, 100%. And again, I go back to, I think in that time, there hadn't been enough queer representation, one, but also queer leadership. And the reason why I say that is because I think a lot of queer creatives today are taking a lot of leadership where it's no longer, I'm a supporting role, bitch. Like, I can be a front runner, and the queerness is not the center of my story, but rather the sazón I'm bringing to the work. You know what I mean? Oh, that's a line, bitch. That's a line. Work. The sazón. Yeah. The sazón. That's what I'm bringing to the work, because I think it's, I mean, it's real. And here's the thing. I don't necessarily know. And again, I don't identify as trans. I do identify as non-binary. But I constantly wonder about, because I know one thing that came up to me as I was thinking and watching the film was the casting of Hilary Swank.
Yeah. Right?
Because there are definitely going to be folks who are going to be like, well, you should have casted a trans person.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I just don't know if I were to identify as trans, if I wanted to relive a trauma so like that.
Work. That's also like, that's the double-edged sword, right? Like, would a trans man take this role? If it was like, let's say for the sake of argument, like this movie was being made today. Like, it wasn't made in 1993 or 1999, it was made today. Would they want to do that? Because then what comes to mind is the movie Till. I don't know if you saw the Emmett, like, Till, the one that came out with the Oscar movie.
I haven't seen it. Is it good?
It's like, I love that director, Chinoya. But also, she made the mindful decision not to show the beating.
Good.
You hear it, but you don't see it. But then she did do the decision to show the open casket, because that was the whole story with Emmett Till. And how that was handled, I really don't think Till was given enough credence, but also I get it, because I think a lot of people are tired of trauma. But I look at Till and I kind of remember and kind of relate it to Boys Don't Cry, because both of them are important stories. But
100.
But why do we have to relive that trauma again?
100%. The only thing I could think of, like, maybe, and this is interesting, right? Like, again, because I wouldn't want a trans person, especially if we're telling stories. I think, for example, the story of Laverne Cox's character in Orange is the New Black, where there is an episode where Laverne, it pre-transition, right? And it's just a good thing that Laverne has a twin brother.
A twin brother, yeah. I remember that episode specifically. Yeah. But that was like such a good episode too. It was
100%. But that's a thing. Like, now imagine asking a trans person, a trans actor, to detransition for the sake of the work. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a very good question.
And I
leave that to the listeners, trans 100%, listeners, if you're listening.
Yeah, I'd be curious, you know, to know what that feels like and what that looks like. Because the only thing that I could think of and where I felt comfortable as Hilary Swank, as the one cast to play this role, is that, cool, now you have, as someone, a cis woman who lived this experience, an opportunity to find a way to bridge and to be in conversation with trans community, right? Like, I think a lot of the times, one thing, maybe it's the fact that I've been an organizer longer than I've been an artist, but I'm always thinking about, like, what does the community care after these stories are put out? Like, is there the community liaison that is in part of the production? Because at the end of the day, listen, not you writing a story about gentrification, and all the people on your show are gentrifiers. Ooh.
Yeah, word.
But listen, I wanna go back. Another thing that was interesting about Boys Don't Cry, and then I don't know how to two things. Talk about double-edged sword. I feel like for me internally, it was like, girl, good thing I was born and raised in L.A. Like, Nebraska. Listen, let me be real. The second thing, though, is that there's common, I don't know if it's a misconception or not, that queer is only limited to urban.
That's right, too. It's like, I think that word, and I think a lot of people don't realize that, and although, I mean, I grew up in Texas mostly, but I was like in the suburbs in Texas. I wasn't in the country, but still it was Texas, you know, growing up queer in Texas in general, you know, in a military immigrant family. Listen, and then going back to what I was saying before, and I'm not saying that, like, I love my family, but it's just, there was this, like, I think when you're closeted and you're at home and your family members, whether it be your immediate family, uncles, aunties, tias, you know, all, cousins, when you're constantly told by your culture that being feminine is horrible, that being feminine is bad, that being, like, calling yourself a sissy, stop being bakla or stop being, you know, gay, you don't feel safe at home. And I'm not saying at home as in a shelter. I'm saying home as in a family. So, like, going back to the saying, like, when you're queer or a person of color or whatever, you know, you learn to build a thick skin fast because you don't feel safe anywhere. So you build your own shelter. You build your own armor. You build your own family that you trust, that you respect, that you know will have your back. And I think that's why, you know, when you get older, it's like, and you're older and queer even, it is harder to make friends sometimes, you know, just because it's like you have this distrust for people, especially in a town like LA. Come on. Everyone in this damn bitch of a town is distrustful.
It's because you're meeting the transplant.
I know. No, but I think I never realized how much this movie would kind of bought up. And how a lot has changed and how a lot hasn't changed. We have the language now. I think the one thing that changed is the language. And that language could have helped a lot with this movie, I feel.
Think then that if we were to put sort of like, talk about binaries, my bad. But like the flip side or a flip contemporary movie that I think comes to mind that Boys Don't Cry would be the antithesis to Moonlight.
Wow. That's
you
deep.
See what I'm saying? Like there's an interesting parallel structure, I think. But the language is different, the tension is different, the trauma is different too, but it feels very much in.
But that's kind of what Barry Jenkins is really, really so good at, though, right? He's really good at creating poetry out of horrible moments.
100%.
But also respecting the moment, allowing us to live in it and kind of be all, this is what happened. Now this is what we could do better. And we see that in Moonlight. And I don't know if you saw the Underground Railroad, which he also did. There are moments in that series about slavery where it's very graphic, but it's still not traumatic. But with Moonlight, I'm so glad you said that, because there is the queerness is bought up. Remember, it made me bawl my eyes out when that little boy was just like, oh, what's a faggot? That was when I was like, oh, I'm done. But even there's trauma in that, but there's also learning in that, and there's the way that it's handled is just so, like, yeah, there's trauma in it, but it's also hopeful, and it's also kind of, there is just a totally different approach there than with, but I like how you said it's the antithesis to Boys Don't Cry. That's kind of brilliant.
We try. One thing I do wanna have 5 seconds to mourn Candace. Because
I get it. Candace, we loved you.
That was so
she did not deserve that.
No, she didn't. And no, she fucking didn't. See, fucking toxic masculinity, the patriarchy. I can't wait. I curse all patriarchy. I hope you fucking fall and die and do.
Oh. Candace died in front of her child. Listen,
dude.
And then that's kind of what made me ask. I was, this is kind of, I really, if I could, I would, I mean, I'm probably, you know, I would really want to talk to Kimberly and Hillary about this movie. And maybe, no, I think mainly just Hillary and Kimberly. I wouldn't include Chloe in there, but I feel like I'm so curious about what Hillary did during this time, because what kind of toll it had on her. Like, what did she learn? Does she have more empathy for trans people now more than, like, after that movie? And, like, does she look back on that now and, like, oh, is she like, oh, that wasn't a bad choice, but I'm glad I know what I know now, you know? That
100. Kind of
thing. Yeah, yeah.
100%.
Yeah. I'm sure she's a great person.
No, 100%. And again, the context culture, I love it, right? Like, we have to situate the movies in the sociology of its time, which I think is very valid. I wish some of this Gen Zers would understand that. But no.
No, and I think we all fall into that trap because everyone is living in this era of, like, who could get mad first and the fastest? We always are looking for something to be mad at, right? Because
everyone's trying to trauma bond.
Yeah, and we trauma bonded over a goddamn pandemic. So, like, isn't that enough?
Right. And we all collectively lived
that. The whole world.
The whole world.
I just think, like, this movie is, it's very, 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 very bad and problematic. But also, it was a product of its time. And it's you can't not talk about this movie when you're talking about queer representation. You cannot talk about it.
Yeah. And I think that was part of the reason why I wanted
about it. Yeah.
100%. I think right. That's exactly why I wanted to bring it into this conversation. Because I'm like, I don't know. No, that's not my go-to movie. But it's still part of the conversation because I think it's important to know how it formulated even my own understanding of what queerness was. I knew I never was going to go to a small town. I knew not to trust the police. Tell me that. This movie didn't tell me that.
We didn't need it. We didn't even know that.
Yeah. Also, the problematic ass questioning and shit. Like, it was just a lot. The one
When Brandon was being questioned by the officer and, like, oh, wouldn't you think they would have put their finger in you? I was like, what the fuck, man? Like you said, there's this hyper focus on genitalia, on sex, on penetration, on, like, all Brandon's area.
After they pulled your pants down and seen you as a girl, what'd he do?
But, like, the only moment, even in the moment when Brandon and Lena are getting intimate and are having sex, there's a moment where, like, she tries to, you know, it's still about genitals, I feel. Although it was a beautiful moment.
But here's the flip side. The second part is interesting because I think the second part operates a little bit more in the queerness of it all. Because the second time that Lena and Brandon have intimacy, Lena is like, no, 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 but I want you to feel the way you make me feel.
Okay. You're right about that. But then there's
Brandon dysphoria being like, but no, not yet. Like, I need to sit with, girl, I need to align with what's going on before I invite you into this moment. You know what? The one moment of joy, but it's still very sad because it's not really joy. It's more empathy and compassion. I really appreciated the nurse doing the rape kit.
I need for you to take your pants off, okay? How do you know they raped me?
Oh, because she was so kind. And it's like, and I think that was another good thing, but also a bad thing, is that Brandon never got kindness from anyone. And when he does get it, it's like, so like, oh, let's just kind of keep that. And it was just basically the nurse and Lena and Candace as well. But Candace was a little bit.
Yeah, Candace had her moment of redemption.
Yeah.
She did.
But also, I do want to bring up, I don't know, I hate bring, like, right before Brandon gets shot, I don't know if you noticed it, Brandon looked at Lena and kind of smiled, and then he got shot. I don't know if it was just me, But it was like this moment of peace, and then he died, right?
Like, if it was like, if I'm gonna die in this moment, at least I die seeing you.
Why didn't you leave? We can still do it.
Yes.
Ooh,
work. And it was, and then the homeboy with the mullet shot Becky from Roseanne. And
not Becky,
but but no, I just think that this was a very interesting movie to kind of revisit and to kind of unpack again. And it's very interesting to talk about this, because we have to talk about it. I don't know if you know Treyvel Anderson. Treyvel Anderson is a black trans author and journalist, a good friend of a friend of mine, and they recently just wrote a book. I'm going to show it to you, called We See yeah. Each Other, a black trans journey through TV and film. It's really good.
Shut
and
the front door.
Yeah, they bring up Treyvel brings up a really good point about exactly what you said about Boys Don't Cry in this, about like how, why do I need a, I don't want to visit that. I don't want to go back, but it's a part of canon. It's a part of queer canon. But I also, it should go without, you know, I should also mention that in 2019, Boys Don't Cry celebrated its 20th anniversary. And during
don't
that,
tell me that they re-released it.
No, they didn't re-release. But it was in 2019 put added to the National Film Registry along with Purple Rain, She's Gotta Have It, Clerks, Amadeus, and Coal Miner's Daughter, and and in 2019 during that 20th anniversary, it was, and Treyvel's book points out, it was like this landmark year for trans masculine representation in TV and film. There was Isaiah Standard on NBC's, I think that's Isaiah, is that the last name? I may get that last name wrong. NBC's Good Girls, Alex Blue Davis on Grey's Anatomy, Logan Ross and David Makes Man. There was the Tales of the City reboot, Asia Kate Dillon was on John Wick 3. And then the L Word Generation Q came out in 2019 as well. So to kind of see that happen, there was this kind of like poetic symmetry to it. Like there's this 100%. Like very... There's this kind of very like, oh, we have come a long way, but also we have a long way to go. I hate saying that out loud, but we do.
100%. And, you know what was interesting? And it's funny that like in her acceptance speech when Hillary Swank wins, and I think it's also very iconic to say, very crucial, imperative to say that she wins her first Oscar nomination.
Yeah,
for leading actress for her role as Brandon Tina in Boys Don't Cry in the year 2000. And I say that to say, because of the complexity, I think now there's even a lot of conversation of like, there is no space for non-binary actors and actresses or actors. I like actors to be even nominated for an Academy. Like, where do we go? And
yeah,
you know, to think about that. But even then, again, to think about a leading actress for playing the role of a trans man, sort of the gender fuckery of it all. And it's interesting. I totally forget the verbiage that was used, but you should definitely go and hear the way that the announcer announces the description of the film, because there's definitely a little bit of a pause. The way they describe Boys Don't Cry was hilarious.
What did they say?
I can't remember the exact verbiage, but I think it was a story of Brandon Tina, a boy living as a girl.
Oh, that's during the Oscars.
Oscars, something like that.
Hilary Swank in Boys Don't Cry.
This is Hilary Swank's first Oscar nomination. She lived as a boy for 1 month to prepare for the role of Tina Brandon, a true story of a boy, girl living as a boy in Nebraska.
But there's what's interesting to me is that there's a little bit of a hesitancy. Like, if you're listening and analyzing sound, maybe I'm weird like that, but I'm constantly analyzing everything.
Because it was probably some white man saying it that was like, wait, what's going on here?
100%. Yeah, you hear that little interpolation that it was like, even in that moment, it was a gender fuckery to the Academy of not knowing. Like, you know, it's not normalized. It hadn't been normalized at all that you couldn't even read that shit nonchalantly. There was a, you had to second guess. And to think about the politic again, I really love that you started this with the context culture, because we really have to talk about it in that context. Problematic, but fave for its moment, right? That I love that for that reason. But interestingly enough, it was just one of those, you know, it just, random thought, got me thinking. What is some queer media that you have consumed recently that's rooted in joy?
I watched Joyride, but there's queerness in there. I watched another movie that's rooted in joy, but I can't say what it is because of NDAs.
she's fancy.
I do think that there are a lot of queer movies coming out
that celebrate joy. I hate you so much. What? Not that being the wraparound to the NDA. Like, let me not tell you the title, but there's some bomb queer movies coming out.
No, I'm trying to think of like, and even TV series. There's that show, Glamorous. Is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Glamorous with Kate Cattrall, and a non-binary actor. But going to what you were saying about the actor actress gendered of it all, and kind of I got where you were going with that. Asia Kate Dillon, there was a whole thing with them when they were submitting themselves for Emmys because they are non-binary, and some people have just pulled themselves out totally of the running because they don't want to be gendered that way. A lot of award shows have now gone non-gendered. MTV Awards, you know, which I guess counts for something. But also Indie Spirit Awards have gone non-gendered. They just do Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, and they have 10 nominees, all different gender identities, which is very interesting. But I like what they're doing with it. Because, again, I think a lot of people, like I was saying, we are always, everyone's out to get mad first and all that good stuff.
Right.
And I'm guilty of it too, but it's like, I'm an impatient bitch. So that's kind of why I get mad. I was like, but then you have to realize, meet kind of movements where they are, right?
Because
are in different communities, right? It's like, we're in the queer community, I'm in the Asian community, but also within the Asian community, I'm in the Filipino community, right? It's like, there's these interesting things that each other, or as they say, intentionally exploited community that I'm a part of, are in different paces in their movements, in their movements for equity and trying to, you almost have to kind of like, okay, I'm here, you know, with this group, but now I have to kind of go meet this group where they are. I'll be right back. That kind of thing. It's a very interesting thing to navigate, and especially when you're someone who expects so much from yourself, and you expect so much from people around you. You're like, oh, you need to match my energy, bitch. You know, it's like, match what I want. But it doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
I'm like, I think that's the yearning of a traumatic body trying to belong. Because I'm like, I'm not gonna sit here and like cancel my mother, like, you know, she was gendered to me all the time, but I know the relationship I have with that woman and I know the trauma that raised me, so I'm okay.
But so Boys Don't Cry, their budget, the budget of the movie was $2 million, which in that it's considered indie, I guess. Its opening weekend was it earned about $73,000, but its total international box office was $11.5 million. So for a film of this nature, I think, you know, that's good. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 90% on the tomato meter, certified fresh out of 83 reviews. It has an 87% audience score from 50K+ ratings. So people like it. People love trauma, I guess. Ugh. Gross. And as you said, so we said it, this was added to the National Film Registry in 2019. It got tons of award season of attention in the 1999-2000 award season. As you said, Hilary Swank won the Oscar for Best Lead Actress. Chloe Sevigny was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. And this was kind of Hillary's intro into the Hollywood elite, right? She went on to go star in like $1 Million Baby. I remember Hillary from 90210, Beverly Hills 90210. That's also showing my age. And also the next Karate Kid. And also Hilary Swank is a great, she seems like a great human being, right?
She does.
She's, you know, beautiful gowns. There was a lot of interviews with Kimberly Pierce when this movie came out. There was one interview on CNN that I was reading where she talked about how the news coverage on Brandon Tina when she was doing her research was very sensational, and she couldn't find a kind of just like a human story about Brandon because media is trash. Kimberly Pierce said this about the movie. The movie itself is an emotional artifact. That's what I'm interested in, creating states of emotion for the audience. That's how I watch movies. I can love all these different kinds of movies, but what I really love is when they get inside my nervous system. Interesting. People were focusing on the crime without giving it much emotional understanding, and I think that's really dangerous, especially with the culture of violence that we live in, Pierce says. In duplicating any sort of hate crime, I think you have a responsibility to figure out moment by moment what was motivating this violence to happen. Keep it personal, keep it close, keep it dramatic. That's an interesting statement. I get it, but I'm like all, I don't.
But the moment by moment, the motivation for this violence to happen, yes, she does that. But for John.
Work, you're right.
Because John feels betrayed. John feels lied to. We know this because there's a friendship and a rapport that's been established. That's not coming from the gays of Brandon. That's all coming from John. So, of course, in that trauma and betrayal, I'm going to react with violence because I don't know how else to react.
Sexual identity crisis.
Hey, what's up?
Hey.
Brandon, turn around and walk out the door right now. This is a nut house.
Are you a girl or are you not?
Ooh, work. Look at you.
But it's not coming from the gaze of the queer person. And this is where lived experience is necessary. Because... Yeah. And so what I think it really is, and by the up close, I think it's because you want the intention is to have straight people feel guilty.
Yeah. Oh,
literally.
Unpack. Yeah. It is that, you know, kind of heterosexual guilt kind of thing, but
100%.
I do think, again, I feel like I'm just now learning that representation is this like really interesting process, you know, and I think also with this movie, since there was a real life person attached to it and this kind of groundbreaking queer moment, like a Matthew Shepard kind of situation or any other queer, you know, person, you know, that puts so much weight on it. But also you kind of add in other things of like, oh, where it took place, what kind of casting it is, why, you know, what about, you know, other stories that aren't white. You know, there's so much with these kinds of stories that people are so ready to kind of attack and sink their teeth into that it just makes it very... Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just makes it very... I don't think I'm going to watch it again, honestly. I'm fine with not watching it again, but I think... So what are your final thoughts on Kimberly Pierce's... Boys Don't Cry.
Kimberly Pierce would have become the head of the Department of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for directing Boys Don't Cry.
I, if this were released today, she would be the go-to for all trans things.
On trans issues.
Forget about going to, you know, Angelica Ross or any of these other black, you know, queer trans women. You know, go to Kimberly Pierce.
Go to Kimberly Pierce.
No, no shade to you, Miss Pierce. We oh, love no, no, the movie.
None whatsoever. Again, context culture 2000. Thank you.
Shout out to Amy Nicholson for giving us the term context culture. That you could listen to that in the episode of Revenge of the Nerds, episode 3. Please, I think it's episode 3. Or episode 2. Just look it up on the thing.
I be forgetting all the time too.
So, Jose, can the people reach you at on the socials? Are you on Twitter anymore? Are you on Instagram anymore? Any of these other things?
So folks can find me on Instagram at soynalgona and then at frutafresca.podcast.
Yeah. So at frutafresca.podcast is the
podcast.
Podcast for the Instagram account for the podcast, right? And then the other one is your own personal one. Cool. And yeah, and then go subscribe to Fruit of Fresca on wherever you get podcasts. It's fantastic. You know, and thank you for listening to this. And thank you, Jose, for talking to me about this very traumatic movie that I'm like really still torn about this movie, to be honest with you. Like, it's important, but it's also like, oh God. Jose, thank you so much. We've talked to death about this, but we hope y'all enjoyed it. Thank you, Jose. Thank you, Kimberly Pierce, for this movie.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
The Problematic Fave podcast is presented by Diaspora and is created, hosted, and produced by Dino Ray Ramos. The series is also produced by Sanjay Sharma of Marginal Media Works and edited by Brian Aguilar. Special thanks to Cam. Subscribe to Problematic Fave on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate us. Diaspora is a media platform that amplifies intentionally exploited communities through its work. Follow Diaspora at Real Diaspora on Instagram and Twitter, or visit thediasporatimes.com. Follow Marginal at MRGNL Media on Instagram. You can send us all your problematic faves on social or email us at thisisdiaspora@gmail.com.